also evokes TCP flow control with its characteristic sawtooth. Squirrels and pigeons going after human food scraps will creep forward a step at a time, occasionally leap back, then steadily creep forward again. And it may be that human communications themselves mirror the very protocols that transmit them. Every text message or email reply encourages yet another, while every unreturned message stanches the flow. More broadly, AIMD suggests an approach to the many places in life where we struggle to allocate limited resources in uncertain and fluctuating conditions. The satirical Peter Principle, articulated in the 1960s by education professor Lawrence J. Peter, states that every employee tends to rise to his level of incompetence. The idea is that in a hierarchical organization, anyone doing a job proficiently will be rewarded with a promotion into a new job that may involve more complex and/or different challenges. When the employee finally reaches a role in which they don't perform well, their march up the ranks will stall, and they will remain in that role for the rest of their career. Thus it stands to reason, goes the ominous logic of the Peter Principle, that eventually every spot in an organization will come to be filled by someone doing that job badly. Some 50 years before Peter's formulation, Spanish philosopher José Ortega y Gasset, in 1910, voiced the same sentiment. "Every public servant should be demoted to the immediately lower rank," he wrote, "because they were advanced until they became incompetent." Some organizations have attempted to remediate the Peter Principle by simply firing employees who don't advance. The so-called cravath system, devised by leading law firm Cravath, Swain & Moore, involves hiring almost exclusively recent graduates, placing them into the bottom ranks, and then routinely either promoting or firing them over the following years. In 1980, the U.S. Armed Forces adopted a similar up-or-out policy with the Defense Officer Personnel Management Act. The United Kingdom has likewise pursued what they call manning control, to great controversy. Is there any alternative, any middle path, between the institutional stagnation of the Peter Principle and the draconian severity of the up-or-out system? The AIMD algorithm can offer just such an approach, since it's explicitly designed to handle the demands of a volatile environment. A computer network must manage its own maximum transmission capacity, plus the transmission rates of its clients, all of which may be fluctuating unpredictably. Likewise, in a business setting, a company has a limited pool of funds to pay for its operations, and each worker or vendor has a limited capacity for the amount of work they can do and the amount of responsibility they can handle. Everyone's needs, capacities, and partnerships are always in flux. The lesson of the TCP sawtooth is that in an unpredictable and changing environment, pushing things to the point of failure is indeed sometimes the best, or the only way, to use all the resources to their fullest. What matters is making sure that the response to failure is both sharp and resilient. Under AIMD, every connection that isn't dropping the ball is accelerated until it is, and then it's cut in half and immediately begins accelerating again. And though it would violate almost every norm of current corporate culture, one can imagine a corporation in which, annually, every employee is always either promoted a single step up the org chart or sent part of the way back down. As Lawrence J. Peter saw it, the insidious Peter Principle arises in corporations because of the first commandment of hierarchical life: the hierarchy must be preserved. TCP, in contrast, teaches the virtues of flexibility. Companies speak of flat hierarchies and tall hierarchies, but they might consider speaking of dynamic ones. Under an AIMD system, no one is long anxious about being overtaxed, nor long resentful about a missed promotion. Both are temporary and frequent correctives, and the system hovers near its equilibrium despite everything changing all the time. Perhaps one day we'll speak not of the arc of one's career, but rather of its sawtooth. Backchannels, flow control in linguistics. Looking into networking's flow control, makes it clear that upstream ACK packets not only acknowledge and confirm transmissions, but shape the contours of the entire interaction, its pace and cadence. This offers us both a reminder and an insight into how important feedback is to communication. In TCP, as we've seen, there's no such thing as a one-way transmission. Without consistent feedback, the sender will slow down almost immediately. Curiously, the rising awareness of the critical role of feedback in the field of networking mirrored an almost identical set of developments going on around the same time in the linguistics community. In the middle of the 20th century, linguistics was dominated by the theories of Noam Chomsky, which considered language in its most perfect and ideal state. Perfectly fluent, grammatical, uninterrupted sentences, as if all communication were written text. But starting in the 1960s and 70s, a surge of interest in the practical aspects of spoken language revealed just how elaborate and subtle the processes are that govern turn-taking, interruption, and composing a sentence or story on the fly while being attuned to a listener's reactions every step of the way. What emerged was a vision of even ostensibly one-way communication as a collaborative act. As linguist Victor Ingve would write in 1970, "In fact, both the person who has the turn and his partner are simultaneously engaged in both speaking and listening. This is because of the existence of what I call the back channel, over which the person who has the turn receives short messages such as yes and aha, without relinquishing the turn." An examination of human back channels opened a whole new horizon for the field of linguistics, prompting a complete reevaluation of the dynamics of communication, specifically the role of the listener. In one illustrative study, a team led by Janet Bavelis at the University of Victoria investigated what would happen when someone listening to a personal story got distracted. Not what would happen to the listener's comprehension, but what would happen to the story. With poor feedback, they discovered, the story falls apart. Narrators who told close call stories to distracted listeners told them less well overall, and particularly poorly, at what should have been the dramatic conclusion. Their story endings were abrupt or choppy, or they circled around and retold the ending more than once, and they often justified their story by explaining the obvious close call. We've all had the experience of talking to someone whose eyes drifted away, to their phone perhaps, making us wonder whether our lackluster storytelling was to blame. In fact, it's now clear that the cause and effect are often the reverse. A poor listener destroys the tale. Understanding the exact function and meaning of human backchannels continues to be an active area of research. In 2014, for instance, UC Santa Cruz's Jackson Tolens and Gene Foxtree demonstrated that those inconspicuous ahas and yes and hmms and ohs that pepper our speech perform distinct, precise roles in regulating the flow of information from speaker to listener, both its rate and level of detail. Indeed, they are every bit as critical as ACKs are in TCP. Says Tolens, "Really, while some people may be worse than others, bad storytellers can at least partly blame their audience." This realization has had the unexpected side effect of taking off some of the pressure when he gives lectures, including, of course, lectures about that very result. Whenever I give these back-channel talks, I always tell the audience that the way they are back-channeling to my talk right now is changing what I say, he jokes. So they're responsible for how well I do. Buffer bloat. It's the latency, stupid. Developing effective active queue management has been hampered by misconceptions about the cause and meaning of queues. Kathleen Nichols and Van Jacobsen. It was the summer of 2010, and like many parents, Jim Geddes was fielding frequent complaints from his children that the family Wi-Fi network was running slowly. Unlike most parents, though, Geddes has worked at HP, Alcatel-Lucent, the World Wide Web Consortium, and the Internet Engineering Task Force. He was literally the editor, in 1999, of the HTTP specification still in use today. So where most geek dads would look into the problem, Geddes looked into the problem. As Geddes would explain to a roomful of Google engineers, with networking jargon giving way to an urgent and unmistakable conviction. I happened to be copying or rsyncing the old ex-consortium archives from my house to MIT over this 10-millisecond long path. SmokePing was reporting latencies averaging well over 1 second, along with bad packet loss, just while copying a file. I took Wireshark and there were these bursts of really strange behavior. This looked like no TCP sawtooth I expected at all. It should never occur that way. In plain English, he saw something very weird. As the saying goes, the most exciting phrase to hear in science, the one that heralds new discoveries, is not Eureka, but that's funny. At first, Geddes thought that something was wrong with his cable modem. What his family had been calling a problem in the internet seemed like a traffic jam at their own wall socket. Packets meant for Boston weren't getting stuck midway there, they were getting stuck in the house. But the deeper Geddes looked into it, the more concerned he grew. The problem didn't affect just his home router and modem, but every home router and modem. And the problem wasn't just in networking devices, it was in computers themselves, in desktops, laptops, tablets, and smartphones, woven into Linux, Windows, and OS X. And it wasn't just in end-user hardware either, it touched the very infrastructure of the internet itself. Geddes sat down to lunches with key players at Comcast, Verizon, Cisco, and Google, including Van Jacobsen and Vint Cerf, and slowly started to piece the puzzle together. The problem was everywhere. And the problem was buffer bloat. A buffer is essentially a queue whose function is to smooth out bursts. If you walked into a donut shop at roughly the same time as another customer, it wouldn't do for the very momentarily overwhelmed cashier to make one of you leave the store and come back another time. Customers wouldn't have it, of course, but neither would management. Such a policy is virtually guaranteed to underutilize the cashier. Putting the customers in a queue instead ensures that the average throughput of the store approaches its maximum throughput. That's a good thing. This superior resource utilization comes with a very real cost, however. Delay. When Tom took his daughter to a Cinco de Mayo festival in Berkeley, she set her heart on a chocolate banana crepe, so they got in line and waited. Eventually, after 20 minutes, Tom got to the front of the line and placed his order. But after paying, they then had to wait 40 more minutes to actually get the crepe. Like Jim Geddes, Tom quickly found himself fielding a substantial volume of familial complaints. Taking orders turned out to take less time than making crepes, so the queue to order was just the first part of the problem. At least it was visible, though. Customers knew what they were in for. The second, longer queue was invisible. So in this case, it would have been a much happier outcome for all if the crepe stand had just cut off the line at some point and put up a sign that they weren't taking orders for a bit. Turning customers away would have made everyone better off, whether they ended up in a shorter crepe line or went elsewhere. And wouldn't have cost the crepe stand a dime of lost sales, because either way, they can only sell as many crepes as they can make in a day, regardless of how long their customers are waiting. This is precisely the phenomenon that Jim Geddes was observing in his home cable modem. Because he was uploading a file, his computer was sending the modem as many upstream packets as it could handle. And the modem was pretending to handle a lot more than it actually could, turning none away while building up a massive queue. So when Geddes tried to download something at the same time, to visit a web page or check email, his ACK packets would get stuck behind the upload, having to wait in line at the modem to leave the house. Because his ACKs then took forever to return to the web and email servers, the servers would in turn throttle their own downstream connection speeds to a corresponding crawl. It was like trying to have a conversation where every time you say, uh-huh, it is delayed by 10 or 20 seconds. The speaker is going to slow way down, assuming you aren't comprehending them, and there's nothing you can do about it. When a networking buffer fills up, what typically happens is called tail drop, an unceremonious way of saying that every packet arriving after that point is simply rejected and effectively deleted. Turning new customers away from the crep stand once the line gets too long would be a version of tail drop in a human context. Given the postal metaphor for packet switching, it might seem a bit odd to imagine a mail carrier who simply vaporizes every parcel that doesn't fit onto the truck that morning. Yet it's precisely such packet drops that lead a computer to notice that one of its packets hasn't been acknowledged, prompting AIMD to start having the bandwidth. Dropped packets are the internet's primary feedback mechanism. A buffer that's too large, a restaurant taking every order no matter how short-staffed the kitchen, a modem taking every packet that comes in regardless of how long it'll take to send them on, prevents this moderation from happening as it should. Fundamentally, buffers use delay, known in networking as latency, in order to maximize throughput. That is, they cause packets, or customers, to wait, to take advantage of later periods when things are slow. But a buffer that's operating permanently full gives you the worst of both worlds. All the latency and none of the give. Smoothing out bursts is great if you are, on average, clearing things at least as quickly as they're arriving. But if your average workload exceeds your average work rate, no buffer can work miracles. And the bigger the buffer is, the further behind you'll get before you start signaling for help. One of the fundamental principles of buffers, be they for packets or patrons, is that they only work correctly when they are routinely zeroed out. For decades, computer memory was sufficiently expensive that there was simply no reason to build modems with oodles of unnecessary memory capacity. Thus, there had simply been no way for a modem to build up a queue bigger than it could handle. But at some point, as economies of scale in the computer industry radically lowered the cost of memory, modem manufacturers started giving their machines gigabytes of RAM because that was effectively the smallest amount of RAM they could get. As a result, the ubiquitous device buffers in modems, routers, laptops, smartphones, and in the backbone of the internet itself became thousands of times too big before people like Jim Geddes sounded the alarm to do something about it. Better never than late. Take your most basic problem as a single person. Someone likes you, you don't like them back. At one point, that used to be kind of an awkward situation. You had to have a conversation. It was weird. Now what do? Someone likes you, you don't like them back? You just pretend to be busy. Forever. Aziz Ansari. Now is better than never. Although never is often better than right now. The Zen of Python. Singer Katy Perry has 107% more Twitter followers than her home state of California has people. The most followed person on Twitter, as of early 2016, she counts some 84.2 million accounts among her fans. This means that even if 99% of her fans never message her at all, and even if that most devoted 1% who message her do so only once per year, then she still gets 2,225 messages a day. Every single day. Imagine if Perry were committed to answering each fan message in the order received. If she could reply to 100 a day, then the fans' expected wait time for a response would soon be measured in decades. It's fair to imagine that most fans would prefer a slim chance of getting a reply right away to a guaranteed reply 10 or 20 years hence. Note that Perry doesn't have this problem when she leaves a venue and must run a gauntlet of fans expecting an autograph or a few words. Perry does what she can, moves on, and the lost opportunities dissipate. The body is its own flow control. We can't be in more than one place at one time. At a crowded party, we inevitably participate in less than 5% of the conversation and cannot read up or catch up on the remainder. Photons that miss the retina aren't cued for later viewing. In real life, packet loss is almost total. We use the idiom of dropped balls, almost exclusively in a derogatory sense, implying that the person in question was lazy, complacent, or forgetful. But the tactical dropping of balls is a critical part of getting things done under overload. The most prevalent critique of modern communications is that we are always connected. But the problem isn't that we're always connected. We're not. The problem is that we're always buffered. The difference is enormous. The feeling that one needs to look at everything on the internet or read all possible books or see all possible shows is buffer bloat. You miss an episode of your favorite series and watch it an hour, a day, a decade later. You go on vacation and come home to a mountain of correspondence. It used to be that people knocked on your door, got no response, and went away. Now they're effectively waiting in line when you come home. Heck, email was deliberately designed to overcome tail drop. As its inventor, Ray Tomlinson, puts it, at the time, there was really no good way to leave messages for people. The telephone worked up to a point, but someone had to be there to receive the call. And if it wasn't the person you wanted to get, it was an administrative assistant or an answering service or something of that sort. That was the mechanism you had to go through to leave a message, so everyone latched onto the idea that you could leave messages on the computer. In other words, we asked for a system that would never turn a sender away. And for better or worse, we got one. Indeed, over the past 15 years, the move from circuit switching to packet switching has played itself out across society. We used to request dedicated circuits with others. Now we send them packets and wait expectantly for X. We used to reject. Now we defer. The much lamented lack of idleness one reads about is perversely the primary feature of buffers, to bring average throughput up to peak throughput. Preventing idleness is what they do. You check email from the road, from vacation, on the toilet, in the middle of the night. You are never, ever bored. This is the mixed blessing of buffers, operating as advertised. Vacation email autoresponders explicitly tell senders to expect latency. A better one might instead tell senders to expect tail drop. Rather than warning senders of above average queue times, it might warn them that it was simply rejecting all incoming messages. And this doesn't need to be limited to vacations. One can imagine an email program set to auto-reject all incoming messages once the inbox reached, say, 100 items. This is ill-advised for bills and the like, but not an unreasonable approach to, say, social invitations. The idea of encountering a full inbox or full voicemail is an anachronism now, a glaring throwback to the late 20th century and the early 2000s. But if the networks that connect our newfangled phones and computers with their effectively infinite storage are still deliberately dropping packets when things get fast and furious, then maybe there's reason to think of tail drop not as the lamentable consequence of limited memory space, but as a purposeful strategy in its own right. As for network buffer bloat, the ongoing story is a complicated but happy one, involving large-scale efforts by hardware and operating system manufacturers to make fundamental changes to network queues. There's also a proposal for a new back channel for TCP, the first such modification in many years, explicit congestion notification, or ECN. Fully extricating the internet from buffer bloat will draw on all of these changes and require the patience of many years. This is a long-term swamp, says Geddes. But there's a lot to look forward to about a post-buffer bloat future. With their inherent latency, buffers are bad for most interactive processes. When we speak via Skype, for example, we generally prefer an occasionally staticky signal now to a clear recording of what our caller said 3 seconds ago. For gamers, even a 50-millisecond lag could be the difference between fragging and being fragged. In fact, gaming is so sensitive to latency that all important gaming honors are still contested in person, with players boarding airplanes to gather and compete over a network serving just a single room. And much the same is true for anything else where being in sync matters. If you want to play music with your friends, even in your metropolitan area, you care about tens of milliseconds, Geddes notes, imagining a whole host of new applications and businesses that might spring forth to take advantage of the interactive potential of low latencies. A generalization I take away from this whole experience is that engineers should think about time as a first-class citizen. Apple's Stuart Cheshire concurs that it's high time for latency to become a top priority for network engineers. He's appalled that companies who advertise fast internet connections refer only to high bandwidth, not to low delay. By analogy, he notes that a Boeing 737 and a Boeing 747 both fly at about 500 miles per hour. The former can hold 120 passengers, while the latter carries three times as many. So, would you say that a Boeing 747 is three times faster than a Boeing 737? Of course not, Cheshire exclaims. Capacity does matter sometimes. For transferring large files, bandwidth is key. If you've got a huge amount of cargo to move, a container ship may well trump thousands of trips by a 747. For interhuman applications, however, a quick turnaround time is often far more important, and what we really need are more concords. And indeed, bringing latencies down is one of the current frontiers of networking research, and it will be interesting to see what that brings. Meanwhile, there are other battles to be waged. Geddes snaps his attention away for a second, looking out of the frame. It's not working for you? I'm talking to someone at the moment, and I'll deal with it when I'm finished. We're wrapping up here. No, the 5 gigahertz is working at the moment. The 2.4 gigahertz channel has hung. It's the infamous bug. I'll reboot the router. Which seems an opportune moment to say our goodbyes and release our bandwidth to the commons, to the myriad flows making their additive increase. 11. Game theory, the minds of others. I'm an optimist in the sense that I believe humans are noble and honorable, and some of them are really smart. I have a somewhat more pessimistic view of people in groups. Steve Jobs. An investor sells a stock to another, one convinced it's headed down and the other convinced it's going up. I think I know what you think, but have no idea what you think I think. An economic bubble bursts. A prospective lover offers a gift that says neither, I want to be more than friends, nor, I don't want to be more than friends. A table of diners squabbles over who should treat whom and why. Someone trying to be helpful unintentionally offends. Someone trying hard to be cool draws snickers. Someone trying to break from the herd finds, dismayingly, the herd following his lead. I love you, says one lover to another. I love you too, the other replies. And both wonder what exactly the other means by that. What does computer science have to say about all this? School children are taught to conceive of literary plots as belonging to one of several categories. Man versus nature, man versus self, man versus society. Thus far in the book, we have considered primarily cases in the first two categories. That is to say, computer science has thus far been our guide to problems created by the fundamental structure of the world and by our limited capacities for processing information. Optimal stopping problems spring from the irreversibility and irrevocability of time. The explore-exploit dilemma from time's limited supply. Relaxation and randomization emerge as vital and necessary strategies for dealing with the ineluctable complexity of challenges like trip planning and vaccinations. In this chapter, we shift the focus and consider the remaining two genres, that is, man versus man and man versus society, in effect, the problems that we pose and cause each other. Our best guide to this terrain comes from a branch of mathematics known as game theory, a field that in its classical incarnation had an enormous impact on the 20th century. In the past couple of decades, cross-pollination between game theory and computer science has produced the field of algorithmic game theory, which has already begun to have an impact on the 21st. Recursion. Now, a clever man would put the poison into his own goblet, because he would know that only a great fool would reach for what he was given. I am not a great fool, so I can clearly not choose the wine in front of you. But you must have known I was not a great fool. You would have counted on it, so I can clearly not choose the wine in front of me. The Princess Bride. Arguably the most influential economist of the 20th century, John Maynard Keynes, once said that successful investing is anticipating the anticipations of others. For a share of stock to be sold at, say, $60, the buyer must believe he can sell it later for $70, to someone who believes he can sell it for $80, to someone who believes he can sell it for $90, to someone who believes he can sell it for $100 to someone else. In this way, the value of a stock isn't what people think it's worth, but what people think it's worth. In fact, even that's not going far enough. As Keynes put it, making a crucial distinction between beauty and popularity, professional investment may be likened to those newspaper competitions in which the competitors have to pick out the 6 prettiest faces from 100 photographs, the prize being awarded to the competitor whose choice most nearly corresponds to the average preferences of the competitors as a whole, so that each competitor has to pick not those faces which he himself finds prettiest, but those which he thinks likeliest to catch the fancy of the other competitors, all of whom are looking at the problem from the same point of view. It is not a case of choosing those which, to the best of one's judgment, are really the prettiest, nor even those which average opinion genuinely thinks the prettiest. We have reached the third degree, where we devote our intelligences to anticipating what average opinion expects the average opinion to be. And there are some, I believe, who practice the fourth, fifth, and higher degrees. Computer science illustrates the fundamental limitations of this kind of reasoning with what's called the halting problem. As Alan Turing proved in 1936, a computer program can never tell you for sure whether another program might end up calculating forever without end, except by simulating the operation of that program and thus potentially going off the deep end itself. Accordingly, programmers will never have automated tools that can tell them whether their software will freeze. This is one of the foundational results in all of computer science, on which many other proofs hang. Simply put, any time a system, be it a machine or a mind, simulates the workings of something as complex as itself, it finds its resources totally maxed out, more or less by definition. Computer scientists have a term for this potentially endless journey into the hall of mirrors, minds simulating minds simulating minds. Recursion. In poker, you never play your hand, James Bond says in Casino Royale. You play the man across from you. In fact, what you really play is a theoretically infinite recursion. There's your own hand and the hand you believe your opponent to have, then the hand you believe your opponent believes you have, and the hand you believe your opponent believes you to believe he has, and on it goes. I don't know if this is an actual game theory term, says the world's top-rated poker player, Dan Smith, but poker players call it leveling. Level 1 is I know. 2 is you know that I know. 3, I know that you know that I know. There are situations where it just comes up where you are like, wow, this is a really silly spot to bluff. But if he knows that it is a silly spot to bluff, then he won't call me, and that's where it's the clever spot to bluff. Those things happen. One of the most memorable bluffs in high-level poker occurred when Tom Dwan wagered $479,500 on Texas Hold'em's absolute worst possible hand, the Deuce-7, while literally telling his opponent, Sammy George, that he was holding it. "You don't have Deuce-7," George replied. "You don't have Deuce-7. George folded, and Dwan, with, yes, Deuce-7, took the pot. In poker, recursion is a dangerous game. You don't want to get caught one step behind your opponent, of course, but there's also an imperative not to get too far ahead of them either. There's a rule that you really only want to play one level above your opponent, explains poker professional Vanessa Russo. If you play too far above your opponent, you're going to think they have information that they don't actually have, and they won't be able to glean the information that you want them to glean from your actions. Sometimes poker pros will deliberately bait their opponent into a convoluted recursion, meanwhile playing completely by-the-book unpsychological poker themselves. This is known as luring them into a leveling war against themselves. Luring an opponent into fruitless recursion can be an effective strategy in other games, too. One of the most colorful, bizarre, and fascinating episodes in the history of man versus machine chess came in a 2008 Blitz showdown between American Grandmaster Hikaru Nakamura and leading computer chess program Ribka. In a game where each side got just 3 minutes on the clock to play all of their moves or automatically lose, the advantage surely seemed to be on the side of the computer, capable of evaluating millions of positions every second and of making its move without twitching a muscle. But Nakamura immediately gridlocked the board and proceeded to make repetitive, meaningless moves as fast as he could click. Meanwhile, the computer wasted precious moments fruitlessly searching for winning variations that didn't exist, and doggedly trying to anticipate all the possible future moves by Nakamura, who himself was simply doing the chess equivalent of twiddling his thumbs. When the computer had nearly exhausted its time and began flailing so as not to lose by the clock, Nakamura finally opened the position and crashed through. Given recursion's dangers, how do poker professionals break out of it? They use game theory. Sometimes you can come up with reasons to make exploitive, leveling plays, but a lot of the time you are just making inferior plays for reasons that are really just noise, Dan Smith explains. I try really hard to have a base level of theory understanding in most situations. I always start by knowing, or trying to know, what Nash is. So what is Nash? Reaching equilibrium. You know the rules, and so do I. We know the game, and we're gonna play it. Rick Astley. Game theory covers an incredibly broad spectrum of scenarios of cooperation and competition, but the field began with those resembling heads-up poker. Two-person contests where one player's gain is another player's loss. Mathematicians analyzing these games seek to identify a so-called equilibrium, that is, a set of strategies that both players can follow, such that neither player would want to change their own play, given the play of their opponent. It's called an equilibrium because it's stable. No amount of further reflection by either player will bring them to different choices. I'm content with my strategy, given yours, and you're content with your strategy, given mine. In Rock, Paper, Scissors, for example, the equilibrium tells us, perhaps unexcitingly, to choose one of the eponymous hand gestures completely at random, each roughly a third of the time. What makes this equilibrium stable is that once both players adopt this one-third, one-third, one-third strategy, there is nothing better for either to do than to stick with it. If we tried playing, say, more rock, our opponent would quickly notice and start playing more paper, which would make us play more scissors, and so forth, until we both settled into the one-third, one-third, one-third equilibrium again. In one of the seminal results in game theory, the mathematician John Nash proved in 1951 that every two-player game has at least one equilibrium. This major discovery would earn Nash the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1994 and lead to the book and film A Beautiful Mind about Nash's life. Such an equilibrium is now often spoken of as the Nash equilibrium, the Nash that Dan Smith always tries to keep track of. On the face of it, the fact that a Nash equilibrium always exists in two-player games would seem to bring us some relief from the Hall of Mirrors recursions that characterize poker and many other familiar contests. When we feel ourselves falling down the recursive rabbit hole, we always have an option to step out of our opponent's head and look for the equilibrium, going directly to the best strategy, assuming rational play. In Rock, Paper, Scissors, scrutinizing your opponent's face for signs of what they might throw next may not be worthwhile if you know that simply throwing at random is an unbeatable strategy in the long run. More generally, the Nash equilibrium offers a prediction of the stable long-term outcome of any set of rules or incentives. As such, it provides an invaluable tool for both predicting and shaping economic policy, as well as social policy in general, As Nobel laureate economist Roger Meyerson puts it, the Nash equilibrium has had a fundamental and pervasive impact in economics and the social sciences, which is comparable to that of the discovery of the DNA double helix in the biological sciences. Computer science, however, has complicated this story. Put broadly, the object of study in mathematics is truth. The object of study in computer science is complexity. As we've seen, it's not enough for a problem to have a solution if that problem is intractable. In a game theory context, knowing that an equilibrium exists doesn't actually tell us what it is or how to get there. As UC Berkeley computer scientist Christos Papadimitriou writes, game theory predicts the agent's equilibrium behavior, typically with no regard to the ways in which such a state will be reached, a consideration that would be a computer scientist's foremost concern. Stanford's Tim Roughgarden echoes the sentiment of being unsatisfied with Nash's proof that equilibria always exist. Okay, he says, but we're computer scientists, right? Give us something we can use. Don't just tell me that it's there. Tell me how to find it. And so the original field of game theory begat algorithmic game theory. That is, the study of theoretically ideal strategies for games became the study of how machines and people come up with strategies for games. As it turns out, asking too many questions about Nash equilibria gets you into computational trouble in a hurry. By the end of the 20th century, determining whether a game has more than one equilibrium, or an equilibrium that gives a player a certain payoff, or an equilibrium that involves taking a particular action, had all been proved to be intractable problems. Then, from 2005 to 2008, Papadimitriou and his colleagues proved that simply finding Nash equilibria is intractable as well. Simple games like Rock, Paper, Scissors may have equilibria visible at a glance, but in games of real-world complexity, it's now clear we cannot take for granted that the participants will be able to discover or reach the game's equilibrium. This, in turn, means that the game's designers can't necessarily use the equilibrium to predict how the players will behave. The ramifications of this sobering result are profound. Nash equilibria have held a hallowed place within economic theory as a way to model and predict market behavior, but that place might not be deserved. As Papadimitriou explains, if an equilibrium concept is not efficiently computable, much of its credibility as a prediction of the behavior of rational agents is lost. MIT's Scott Aronson agrees. In my opinion, he says, if the theorem that Nash equilibria exist is considered relevant to debates about, say, free markets versus government intervention, then the theorem that finding those equilibria is intractable should be considered relevant also. The predictive abilities of Nash equilibria only matter if those equilibria can actually be found by the players. To quote eBay's former director of research, Kamal Jan, if your laptop cannot find it, neither can the market. Dominant strategies, for better or worse. Even when we can reach an equilibrium, just because it's stable doesn't make it good. It may seem paradoxical, but the equilibrium strategy, where neither player is willing to change tack, is by no means necessarily the strategy that leads to the best outcomes for the players. Nowhere is that better illustrated than in game theory's most famous, provocative, and controversial two-player game, The Prisoner's Dilemma. The Prisoner's Dilemma works as follows. Imagine that you and a co-conspirator have been arrested after robbing a bank and are being held in separate jail cells. Now you must decide whether to cooperate with each other by remaining silent and admitting nothing, or to defect from your partnership by ratting out the other to the police. You know that if you both cooperate with each other and keep silent, the state doesn't have enough evidence to convict either one of you, so you'll both walk free, splitting the loot. $500,000 each, let's say. If one of you defects and informs on the other, and the other says nothing, The informer goes free and gets the entire $1 million, while the silent one is convicted as the sole perpetrator of the crime and receives a 10-year sentence. If you both inform on each other, then you'll share the blame and split the sentence, 5 years each. Here's the problem. No matter what your accomplice does, it's always better for you to defect. If your accomplice has ratted you out, ratting them out in turn will give you 5 years of your life back. You'll get the shared sentence, 5 years, rather than serving the whole thing yourself, 10 years. And if your accomplice has stayed quiet, turning them in will net you the full $1 million. You won't have to split it. No matter what, you're always better off defecting than cooperating, regardless of what your accomplice decides. To do otherwise will always make you worse off, no matter what. In fact, this makes defection not merely the equilibrium strategy, but what's known as a dominant strategy. A dominant strategy avoids recursion altogether by being the best response to all of your opponent's possible strategies, so you don't even need to trouble yourself getting inside their head at all. A dominant strategy is a powerful thing. But now we've arrived at the paradox. If everyone does the rational thing and follows the dominant strategy, the story ends with both of you serving 5 years of hard time, which, compared to freedom and a cool $500,000 apiece, is dramatically worse for everyone involved. How could that have happened? This has emerged as one of the major insights of traditional game theory. The equilibrium for a set of players, all acting rationally in their own interest, may not be the outcome that is actually best for those players. Algorithmic game theory, in keeping with the principles of computer science, has taken this insight and quantified it, creating a measure called the price of anarchy. The price of anarchy measures the gap between cooperation, a centrally designed or coordinated solution, and competition, where each participant is independently trying to maximize the outcome for themselves. In a game like the Prisoner's Dilemma, this price is effectively infinite. Increasing the amount of cash at stake and lengthening the jail sentences can make the gap between possible outcomes arbitrarily wide, even as the dominant strategy stays the same. There's no limit to how painful things can get for the players if they don't coordinate. But in other games, as algorithmic game theorists would discover, the price of anarchy is not nearly so bad. For instance, consider traffic. Whether it's individual commuters trying to make their way through the daily bumper-to-bumper, or routers shuffling TCP packets across the internet, everyone in the system merely wants what's easiest for them personally. Drivers just want to take the fastest route, whatever it is, and routers just want to shuffle along their packets with minimal effort. But in both cases, this can result in overcrowding along critical pathways, creating congestion that harms everyone. How much harm, though? Surprisingly, Tim Roughgarden and Cornell's Ava Tardosh proved in 2002 that the selfish routing approach has a price of anarchy that's a mere 4/3. That is, a free-for-all is only 33% worse than perfect top-down coordination. Roughgarden and Tardosh's work has deep implications both for urban planning of physical traffic and for network infrastructure. Selfish routing's low price of anarchy may explain, for instance, why the internet works as well as it does without any central authority managing the routing of individual packets. Even if such coordination were possible, it wouldn't add very much. When it comes to traffic of the human kind, the low price of anarchy cuts both ways. The good news is that the lack of centralized coordination is making your commute at most only 33% worse. On the other hand, if you're hoping that networked, self-driving autonomous cars will bring us a future of traffic utopia, it may be disheartening to learn that today's selfish, uncoordinated drivers are already pretty close to optimal. It's true that self-driving cars should reduce the number of road accidents and may be able to drive more closely together, both of which would speed up traffic. But from a congestion standpoint, The fact that anarchy is only 4/3 as congested as perfect coordination means that perfectly coordinated commutes will only be 3/4 as congested as they are now. It's a bit like the famous line by James Branch Cabell, "The optimist proclaims that we live in the best of all possible worlds, and the pessimist fears this is true." Congestion will always be a problem solvable more by planners and by overall demand than by the decisions of individual drivers, human or computer, selfish or cooperative. Quantifying the price of anarchy has given the field a concrete and rigorous way to assess the pros and cons of decentralized systems, which has broad implications across any number of domains where people find themselves involved in game playing, whether they know it or not. A low price of anarchy means the system is, for better or worse, about as good on its own as it would be if it were carefully managed. A high price of anarchy, on the other hand, means that things have the potential to turn out fine if they're carefully coordinated, but that without some form of intervention, we are courting disaster. The prisoner's dilemma is clearly of this latter type. Unfortunately, so are many of the most critical games the world must play. The Tragedy of the Commons. In 1968, the ecologist Garrett Hardin took the two-player prisoner's dilemma and imagined scaling it up to involve all the members of a farming village. Hardin invited his readers to picture a commons of public lawn, available to be grazed by everyone's livestock, but with finite capacity. In theory, all the villagers should graze only as many animals as would leave some grass for everyone. In practice, though, the benefits of grazing a little bit more than that accrue directly to you, while the harms seem too small to be of consequence. Yet if everyone follows this logic of using just slightly more of the commons than they should, a dreadful equilibrium results, a completely devastated lawn, and no grass for anyone's livestock thereafter. Hardin called this the tragedy of the commons, and it has become one of the primary lenses through which economists, political scientists, and the environmental movement view large-scale ecological crises like pollution and climate change. "When I was a kid, there was this thing called leaded gasoline," says Avram Blum, Carnegie Mellon computer scientist and game theorist. "Leaded was 10 cents cheaper or something, but it pollutes the environment. Given what everyone else is doing, how much worse really are you personally health-wise if you put leaded gasoline in your own car? Not that much worse. It's the prisoner's dilemma." The same is true at the corporate and national levels. A recent newspaper headline put the trouble succinctly: "Stable climate demands most fossil fuels stay in the ground, but whose?" Every corporation, and to some degree every nation, is better off being a bit more reckless than their peers for the sake of competitive advantage. Yet if they all act more recklessly, it leads to a ravaged earth and all for nothing. There's no economic advantage for anyone relative to where they started. The logic of this type of game is so pervasive that we don't even have to look to misdeeds to see it running amok. We can just as easily end up in a terrible equilibrium with a clean conscience. How? Look no further than your company vacation policy. In America, people work some of the longest hours in the world. As The Economist put it, nowhere is the value of work higher and the value of leisure lower. There are few laws mandating that employers provide time off, and even when American employees do get vacation time, they don't use it. A recent study showed that the average worker takes only half of the vacation days granted them, and a stunning 15% take no vacation at all. At the present moment, the Bay Area, where the two of us live, is attempting to remedy this sorry state of affairs by going through a radical paradigm shift when it comes to vacation policy. A shift that is very well-meaning and completely apocalyptically doomed. The premise sounds innocent enough. Instead of metering out some fixed arbitrary number of days for each employee, then wasting HR man-hours making sure no one goes over their limit, why not just let your employees free? Why not simply allow them unlimited vacation? Anecdotal reports thus far are mixed, But from a game theoretic perspective, this approach is a nightmare. All employees want, in theory, to take as much vacation as possible. But they also all want to take just slightly less vacation than each other, to be perceived as more loyal, more committed, and more dedicated, hence more promotion-worthy. Everyone looks to the others for a baseline and will take just slightly less than that. The Nash equilibrium of this game is zero. As the CEO of software company Travis CI, Matthias Meyer, writes, "People will hesitate to take a vacation as they don't want to seem like that person who's taking the most vacation days. It's a race to the bottom." This is the tragedy of the commons in full effect. And it's just as bad between firms as within them. Imagine two shopkeepers in a small town. Each of them can choose either to stay open 7 days a week or to be open only 6 days a week, taking Sunday off to relax with their friends and family. If both of them take a day off, they'll retain their existing market share and experience less stress. However, if one shopkeeper decides to open his shop 7 days a week, he'll draw extra customers, taking them away from his competitor and threatening his livelihood. The Nash equilibrium, again, is for everyone to work all the time. This exact issue became a flashpoint in the United States during the 2014 holiday season, as retailer after retailer, unwilling to cede market share to competitors who were getting ahead of the usual post-Thanksgiving shopping rush, caved in toward the lousy equilibrium. Stores are opening earlier than ever before, the International Business Times reported. Macy's opened 2 hours earlier than the year before, as did Target. Kmart, for its part, opened at 6 a.m. on Thanksgiving morning and was continuously open for 42 hours. So what can we as players do when we find ourselves in such a situation? Either the two-party prisoner's dilemma or the multi-party tragedy of the commons. In a sense, nothing. The very stability that these bad equilibria have, the thing that makes them equilibria, becomes damnable. By and large, we cannot shift the dominant strategies from within. But this doesn't mean that bad equilibria can't be fixed. It just means that the solution is going to have to come from somewhere else. Mechanism design. Change the game. Don't hate the player. Hate the game. Ice-T. Don't ever take sides with anyone against the family again. Ever. The Godfather. The prisoner's dilemma has been the focal point for generations of debate and controversy about the nature of human cooperation, but University College London game theorist Ken Binmore sees at least some of that controversy as misguided. As he argues, it's just plain wrong that the prisoner's dilemma captures what matters about human cooperation. On the contrary, it represents a situation in which the dice are as loaded against the emergence of cooperation as they could possibly be. Well, if the rules of the game force a bad strategy, maybe we shouldn't try to change strategies. Maybe we should try to change the game. This brings us to a branch of game theory known as mechanism design. While game theory asks what behavior will emerge given a set of rules, mechanism design, sometimes called reverse game theory, works in the other direction, asking what rules will give us the behavior we want to see. And if game theory's revelations, like the fact that an equilibrium strategy might be rational for each player yet bad for everyone, have proven counterintuitive, the revelations of mechanism design are even more so. Let's return you and your bank-robbing co-conspirator to the jail cell for another go at the prisoner's dilemma, with one crucial addition, the Godfather. Now you and your fellow thief are members